the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We live in a world where a tap on your smartphone can let you live stream a video with someone in Mongolia or order a mousetrap from a company thousands of miles away, which makes it all the stranger and maybe wonderful that in this hyper-connected world, there are still a few dozen tribes of people that live with virtually no contact with the outside world, or what many people would think of as modern civilization. Now, nearly all of these tribes live in remote areas of the Amazon rainforest in Brazil and Peru. They survive by hunting and gathering food in the forest, or by cultivating gardens with handmade tools. In some cases, they don't wear clothing and speak languages that aren't understood by nearly anyone else on Earth. But these so-called uncontacted tribes of the Amazon face increasing pressure from loggers, miners, and missionaries pushing into the lands where they live. Many of the tribes have had bad experiences in the past with outsiders and don't want contact. But a number of sightings and interactions with these people in recent years has raised the question as to how much longer the uncontacted tribes of the Amazon will continue to live apart. On this edition of Global Journalist, we're going to talk about the world's last uncontacted people and some of the ethical challenges raised by our interactions with them. We have a great panel of guests that will dive into this. We're going to start first with Dan Everett. He's a linguist at Bentley University in Waltham, Massachusetts. He spent more than three decades living off and on with the Piraha people. This is an isolated group of a few hundred who live on a tributary of the Amazon in Brazil. Dan's work is the subject of a cover story in the August edition of Harper's. He's also the author of Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes, Life and Language in the Amazonian Jungle. Dan, welcome to Global Journalist.
Great to be here with you this morning.
Well, you, as I mentioned, you spent years and years living among the Piraha people. Tell us about why they have avoided contact with outsiders for so long.
They have avoided contact in a couple of ways and for a couple of reasons. The main reason that the Piraha don't like to have a lot of contact with the outside is because their cultural values are quite distinct from the values of the surrounding Brazilian culture. They really are non-materialistic. They have a number of interesting cultural characteristics that they themselves consider to be incompatible with Brazilian culture. And so, although Brazilians do contact them from time to time, they maintain a distance. And they still are monolingual in their own language after 300 years, after the first contact occurred 300 years ago.
And tell us about the language of the Piraha. What makes it kind of special? I understand you can either speak it, sing it, or sort of whistle it.
Yeah, it's a very interesting language. It's not the only language that can be whistled, but it's a tonal language, which means that they can focus on the tones alone at times, along with some other aspects of the length and in stress and intonation. So I can say kai, which means there's a paca, a rodent over there, or I can whistle it. And it means the same thing, or I can hum it. And these, they use these different, what I call channels of discourse for different purposes. People hum to their children. They whistle when they're hunting. The men do. They have other functions for each channel of speech that they have.
And there are some other special things about the language. I understand that the concept of colors or numbers are kind of foreign to them. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yes, they're the only group in the world that's ever been documented without any numbers, not even the number one. And that's a fairly startling claim. So I've had follow-up research by teams from Columbia University, Stanford, MIT, and the University of Miami have all done independent studies there to confirm this. This is not a deficiency of cognition, because there are some Piraha who can count a bit in Portuguese. It is a cultural choice not to have numbers in their language. The same thing with colors. If they see something that's red and they want to tell me about it, they might say it looks like blood, or they might say it's not yet mature for something that's green, or it looks like water for something that's blue. But they don't have color terms per se.
And what about their sense of time and history? How is that different from our own?
Well, they're also unusual, if not unique, in that they don't have creation myths. They may have had them several hundred years ago, I mean, it's hard to say because this, but they don't have creation myths. They don't believe in God. They have a very unusual the simplest kinship system known. They have what I call a cultural value of immediacy of experience. They prefer to talk about things that they have seen, that they know. They don't talk about the distant past or the distant future. This doesn't mean they're incapable of thinking about those things. It means that in their day-to-day culture, they simply don't talk about those things. They have no value to them.
And you visited the Piraha first as a missionary back in the 1970s and tried to tell them about Jesus and Christianity. What was their reaction?
Well, their reaction, since they put such a high importance on evidence, was they came in one time and they said, "Hey, Dan, so Jesus, is he brown like us or is he white like you?" And I said, "Well, some people say he was brown, some people say he was white." And they said, yeah, but you've seen him, so what does he look like?" And I said, "Well, actually, I've never seen him." And they said, "But your father saw him." I said, "No, my father didn't see him." "Who do you know that saw him?" And I said, "Nobody." And they said, "So then why are you telling us about him?" It just didn't make any sense. And actually, I went there as a strong evangelical, and they converted me to atheism. And today I'm an atheist. And it's because of their demands for evidence and their view of the world that profoundly affected me.
And talk about the Piraha's reaction to you. Now, when you went there in the 1970s, it sounded like they had very little contact with outsiders, and you and your wife, in effect, changed that. How has their culture changed over time?
Well, their culture has changed very minimally since the first description of their culture by Portuguese explorers in the 1700s. In fact, some of the descriptions that were done in the 1700s and the 1800s would fit the Piraha today perfectly fine. They do wear clothes. Some of the villages have more contact. There are villagers that don't live that far from what is today the Trans-Amazon Highway, and so they might have t-shirts and gym shorts for the men and dresses for the women. If you go down a few other villages, you'll find that nobody wears clothes. They're not, you know, nobody cares to keep their clothes. They wear them when they're out in the village, out of the village, because they're good anthropologists, in my opinion, and they don't want to stand out any more than they have to. But they reject the outside world. But the government has wanted to help them, so it sends in health teams. That has changed them a bit. Positively, it's changed them because their population is growing. Negatively, it's changed them because government employees tend to give them lots of starches for free, rice and cookies and things, and introduce television sets in one of the villages with a generator. So that's been somewhat negative. But when I talk to them, I still don't sense that that has become any part of their thinking. It's just a curiosity that when they're visiting that village, they get free rice.
A reminder that you are listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, we're talking about the world's last uncontacted tribes, most of whom live in the Amazon regions of Brazil and Peru, and survive by hunting, fishing, and gathering food in the jungle. We're going to bring in two other experts now who have spent many years following this issue. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Scott Wallace, a journalist who has covered the people of the Amazon for National Geographic and other publications for years. He's the author of the book, The Unconquered, In Search of the Amazon's Last Uncontacted Tribes. And from London, England, we're joined by Sarah Schenker. She's a senior campaigner for Survival International, a group that advocates for indigenous rights around the world. Scott, Sarah, welcome to Global Journalist. Scott Wallace, let me start with you. Just give us a little bit of background here. We heard Dan Everett talking a bit about the Piraha. What does it mean when we say a tribe or a group of people are uncontacted?
No, that's a really good question. First of all, let me start by saying it's an honor to be on this panel today and to share these minutes with Dan and with Sarah and you. But as far as the meaning of uncontacted, that's a really interesting question. I mean, largely we use it as a kind of shorthand now for groups who are living in extreme isolation. There is no pristine, purely uncontacted group left anywhere in the world. I mean, everyone has seen airplanes cross the sky, in many instances in the Amazon, in most cases. what the groups that we call uncontacted have had contact of a non-peaceful nature with outsiders. A question of flying bullets in one direction and maybe flying arrows in the other. But what we mean is there has not been peaceful contact in which has enabled us to study the language of a particular group or to pass pathogens, germs to them for which they have no immunity. So the Piraha, Dan's the group of Dan's study, and whom he's spent a long time with, those would not be, those are not uncontacted groups. There have been anthropologists like and missionaries like Dan in there living among them. The uncontacted groups have not had that kind of contact.
Okay, well, let me turn this to Sarah Shankar, then I understand you have a little bit of problems on your line. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's go back to you, Scott. We lost Sarah momentarily. What are some of the threats or challenges to their way of life that these groups are experiencing right now?
Well, probably one of the most acute problems is illegal logging. Loggers are going ever deeper into the Amazon. They really represent, in many instances, the spearhead of the advance of our Western civilization into the deepest redoubts of the Amazon. So, and often these guys, have a fairly violent disposition. They are there to make money. And if it means clearing Indians out of the way to get to the timber that they seek, they do so. There have been incidents of violent contact between these indigenous communities and the loggers. I would say logging, drug trafficking. These are groups that are going deep, deep into the jungle where previously uncontacted tribes have held forth in almost complete isolation from the outside world. And I would say that those are the two main threats right now: drug traffickers, illegal loggers, and then you have a host of other, threats as well, from government-sponsored oil exploration and infrastructure construction projects. All of these things contribute to a fragmenting of the forest. Settlers going in, illegal settlers following the logging roads that loggers cut, the illegal logging roads. And they start clearing land, and pretty soon you have a fragmented forest.
Let me turn this to Sarah Shankar then, because we heard Scott talking about all the different myriad challenges that are posed to these people now. But I understand that back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there was a rubber boom in the Amazon, and that this has left sort of an incredibly bad legacy for many of these peoples in the Amazon. How did that affect them?
Indeed, the rubber boom was really, really dangerous for indigenous peoples in the region, as is the theft of their land more generally, which has been going on since the colonization of the Americas by the Europeans. And it's something that we see going on until...
I'm sorry, it sounds like we just lost you there. Dan Everett, I understand that Sarah was speaking to this rubber boom back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Dan, I understand that that is something that still affects people's outlook on the world today.
Yes, it does. I've worked with about 20 different Amazonian groups, and one of the groups I worked with was the Oroween. The Oroween are in Rondônia, and they came out of the jungles about 30 years ago, and the entire group had been enslaved by rubber traders, and three or four escaped. Between them, they spoke some Portuguese and remembered some Oroween. But it was a very devastated group of people that came out of the jungle and finally got freedom. And that's only recently. And I worked with them about 20 years ago, just after they had come out.
And Scott Wallace, I understand that Brazil does have this government agency. I think we can call it by its acronym, FUNAI. Tell us about their role and their view on how some of these very vulnerable, isolated tribes should be treated.
Within FUNAI, yes, FUNAI is Brazil's Indigenous Affairs Agency, and within FUNAI, there is a special unit called the Department of Isolated Indians, which is in charge of protecting the last uncontacted tribes or tribes living in extreme isolation. And the Brazilian policy for the last 30 plus years has been to avoid contact with these groups wherever they are, to identify their presence on the land and then expel outsiders and try to keep intruders out and allow these tribes to live as they have, you know, for centuries.
Well, I understand there's this one group in Brazil's Mato Grosso state called the Kawahiva, who are said to kind of live almost permanently on the run. What do we know about them and their situation?
Well, like a number of different tribes whom we call uncontacted today, the Kawahiva are living basically in a state of siege. And they are, so they are, you know, a lot of these tribes were actually previously cultivators. They grew crops, they settled, and they maybe moved seasonally. But a lot of these groups now are under such intense pressure that they are living, as you said, in constant flight from, you know, loggers or land grabbers, land speculators. And so the Kawahiva are one of these groups. We don't know exactly how many of them there are, somewhere between 25 and 50, I think.
Well, the interesting thing about the Kawahiva, if I can butt in for a little bit, is that is the name of a large language, actually. So there have been, and sometimes they're called, you know, the Tenyarin, the Parinchinchins, the Uruwewawaw, but these all speak the same language, which is Kawahiva, studied by the anthropologist Wold Kraki. So there are different. This is a good illustration of how some Kawahiva are totally, the Tenyarin are totally adapted to Brazilian culture, where others run from it and want nothing to do with it.
Well, let me ask you about the politics of this within Brazil, because I suspect when you do have sort of these vast areas in the Amazon, that some of which have been set aside for protected people, there are various political interest groups around that. Scott, how does that sort of shake out within Brazil's national politics?
Yeah, I mean, especially now in Brazil, there's very strong movement to curtail the rights of indigenous groups, to circumscribe their lands, to not grant any more lands to indigenous people. There's a strong sentiment in the national culture that maybe, you know, the tribes have too much land. And particularly as you get closer to the frontier, there's a lot of anti-Indian, anti-federal government seething resentment because the lands that, you know, for example, the Kawahiva, there are 25 to 50 of them, and their reserve is like the size of Delaware. A lot of people...
Sorry, you said there's a reserve the size of Delaware for about 25 to 50 people.
Correct.
Okay, so I can understand why there would be a lot of pressure on those lands then.
Right, and all around them, you know, the valuable hardwoods have already been logged out. So the only valuable stands of trees left in that region are inside the Kawahiva Reserve.
And Dan Everett, I understand that there is sort of one man who's thought to be sort of the last surviving member of his tribe in the Amazon. I think some anthropologists refer to him as the man of the hole or the hole digging man. What do we know about him? Because there has been a number of news reports about him.
Well, actually, he's not the only one. I myself have worked with the last living speaker of one language, which is related to the Oroween, to this larger family called Chapacuran. There are a lot of groups like that. And what Scott was saying about prejudice against Indians is so intense in the border areas that, you know, my life has been threatened on numerous occasions simply because I'm interested in studying these groups.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, we're discussing the world's last uncontacted tribes of people, most of whom live in remote regions of the Amazon rainforest. We're joined by the linguist Daniel Everett of Bentley University and the journalist and author Scott Wallace. Well, Scott Wallace, let me turn this back to you then, because I understand that in Peru, there is this group called the Mashco Piro, who seem to be coming out of the jungle and initiating contact more. Tell us about their activities and some of the ethical issues this is raising.
That's a tricky situation with the Mashco Piro. There are a couple of groups that have been seeking contact or raiding settled communities in the Peruvian Amazon. The Moshko, you know, this is a, they are a as traditionally they are an Arawak tribe. That is the language family that they come from. They traditionally were cultivators. They grew large, you know, gardens. They had lots of land under cultivation. And with the rubber boom that was mentioned earlier in the show, back in the late 19th century, there were a number of massacres committed that left the remains of the Moshko Piro. They fled into the deepest jungle, those who were not either killed or enslaved, and reconstituted themselves in the deepest, most inaccessible redoubts of the forest. That's, in fact, where a lot of these uncontacted groups today are the remnants and the descendants of the survivors of massacres and slaving raids from 100 to 150, 200 years ago. And the Moshko are one of these groups. And now, why are they coming out suddenly, appearing on the riverbanks, seeking food and clothing and other goods from passersby along the rivers, or raiding villages? It appears that they've developed a taste for our industrial goods, whether it's steel axes and machetes, or clothing, or food. And it may be that they are being pressured by loggers and other groups who are invading their territory, and they can no longer sustain themselves without these kinds of raids and taking food and other things from settled villages.
And Sarah Schenker, we'll try your line once again. There are some anthropologists who argue that we should be trying to contact these people, that in fact we can provide them with health care, with medicine, so that children won't die of simple infections or malaria, or that women won't die in childbirth as frequently as they do. Your group takes a different position. Tell us about that.
Yes, indeed. There are certain people, including some anthropologists, who are proposing that outsiders enter uncontacted tribes' territories and make forced contact with those tribes. And they claim that it's inevitable that, they'll be wiped out, and that contacting them is therefore for their own good. These arguments are incredibly dangerous. These are really arrogant, dangerous arguments that could wipe out whole peoples, as we've seen so many times in the past. And Brazil, where I've visited recently, contacted peoples in Brazil several times, and they have so many awful stories to tell about forced contact and how many of their relatives died as a result of the diseases that they contracted, to which they had little resistance, since they're the most vulnerable peoples on the planet. The Brazilian government, for example, has decades of experience of forced contact, because until the 1980s, that was its policy, was to go and make contact with uncontacted tribes and try and integrate them into national society.
Well, here, I'm sorry, we were just talking about these people, I think it's the Moshko Piro, who are coming out of the jungle in Peru and initiating some sort of contact. So what does your group propose as sort of the best way of handling that type of situation?
In that sort of situation where uncontacted people come out of the forest and make contact, of course, then the national governments need to deal with the situation as best they can. They need to send in fully equipped health teams to make sure that there's not great loss of life, as is quite probable. What survival is saying is not that no contact should happen with uncontacted tribes, but what we're all about is choice and self-determination. And the only way that uncontacted tribes will be able to determine their own futures is if their land is protected for them to be able to live on it without being forced to come out of the forest to make contact with outsiders, or outsiders going and contacting them.
Well, Dan Everett, let me turn this to you then, because you did live among the Piraha for years and years and years. You must have seen many people die of diseases that were easily preventable. So how do you fall out on this issue?
I have taken in medicine every time I've gone. I'm not a doctor, but there are some basic diseases they're going to get. I mean, unfortunately, one of the worst is the common cold. And the Piraha are so extreme on this that if they see someone sneezing, they want them out of the village right away if they're an outsider. It has killed lots of people, as have measles and other diseases. in 1962, more or less. A measles epidemic spread through the Pitahā before I got there that wiped out probably 80% of the population. So I tremendously respect Survival International's efforts on behalf of these people. And anyone who goes to a group, even if they're more contacted than other groups, such as the Pitahā, has a responsibility to inform themselves about health emergencies, health needs, and some form of health prevention.
Well, Sarah Shenker, let me go back to you then, because there are some people that argue that many of these tribes are at a tipping point, that the pressures on their lands have become so great that many, many of them are going to start coming out of the jungle, as is the case with the Mashkopiro. What's your take on that?
Well, it's true that if the land of uncontacted tribes is not protected, then they are often forced to come out of the forest. There was the example recently of the Sapanawa tribe on the Brazilian-Peruvian border, some of whom came out and made contact with non-indigenous people, including government representatives. And they reported that their relatives had been massacred and that there were so many deaths that they couldn't even bury everybody and their bodies were eaten by vultures. This clearly showed that those Sapanawa were making contact because they felt they had no other choice. They felt forced out of the forest. And that will continue to happen unless the land is protected, which is why Survival International and our supporters all around the world are lobbying governments and companies to respect the law, international law, national constitution, and protect uncontacted tribes' land before they're wiped out.
Well, Scott Wallace, our time does grow short. Where do you see this issue moving in the next 3, 4, 5 years? Is the future, I mean, is it sustainable for people to live in virtual isolation in the Amazon?
If there is the will to protect these people and to commit the resources and the personnel, it's possible. But there are some very troubling developments. For example, in Brazil right now, the current government is slashing the budget of FUNAI, the Indigenous Affairs Agency, dramatically. And there's concern that the Department of Isolated and Recently Contacted Indians, which is in charge of protecting these groups, they are going to have to close down half of their theaters of operation where they're actually protecting uncontacted or isolated tribes, 6 of the 12 places in the Amazon where they're working. So there's a lot of concern. There are causes for concern right now about the future.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Many thanks to Sarah Shenker, Daniel Everett, and Scott Wallace for joining us. Our assistant producer this week is Rachel Foster Gimbel. Our audio editor is Anadil Iftikhar. Vera Tan is supervising producer. Pat Akers of KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio, is the audio engineer. And Travis McMillan of RJI is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.